This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. You're going to die. We're all going to die. There, I've said it. It's out there. And of course, we all know that, but it's not something you talk about necessarily in polite company. Maybe you share a moment about someone you know in common who recently passed away, or sympathy for a friend whose parent just died. But you don't really ask, apropos of nothing, how someone feels about mortality, grief, spirituality. And yet, if we're all going to have to face it at some point, and we don't usually know when, why don't we discuss these topics more openly, more frequently, and with more ease? Our guests today say there are important conversations to be had that can help influence how we live, as well as what happens when we near death or die. Irene Kakandis and Steve Gordon have just published a book called Let's Talk About Death, Asking the Questions That Profoundly Change the Way We Live and Die. Irene and Steve, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Good morning. Thank you.
Pleasure to talk to you, Jane.
Okay, so we know we're all going to die. Why do we have to talk about it? Steve?
Well, you just summed up a really good way of explaining it. In short form, you could say that if you spend some time getting comfortable with the fact that you're mortal, it could potentially affect the way you will die, and it almost definitely will affect the way you live.
Irene, what do you think?
Well, I think there are some concrete decisions that all of us are likely to have to make about our deaths, and so talking about it beforehand can potentially, I wouldn't say ensure, but help the chances that the way that goes is the way you would like it to go. So that's another reason why talking about it in advance is important.
Well, yeah. I mean, over the years on this show, we've talked with doctors and with hospice nurses and people in the funeral industry and lawyers, and they all tell us the importance of letting loved ones know about your final wishes, how you want to be treated medically, if you're incapacitated, what you want to happen to your body, and in terms of ceremonies after you die. But Irene, what you're advocating for is more than just that, more than leaving a record of your wishes. You're saying we should talk about death in general and our own relationship to our mortality. Why do you feel so strongly about going further than just those specific instructions, although that clearly is important as well?
Right. And I'm going to repeat that. Instructions can be the biggest gift you give your loved ones. They'll be so thankful that you have expressed those. But I feel very, very strongly that if you think about the fact that your life is not just going to go on forever and you realize there is a limited quantity of days ahead of you, you don't know what the limit is, but you do accept the idea that it's limited, it could help you make some choices about what you're going to do today. There's a wonderful hospice nurse that we quote in the book, Barbara Carnes, who talks about don't assume you're going to feel better some other day and put off what you think you need to do. And I think that's good advice, even if you're not close to your death the way some of her audience is. I think the idea that if I love my husband, I might want to express that in some way today has partly to do with I know that he and I are not going to be around together as an item forever. So I'm not going to put it off. I'm going to think about doing it right now.
We're talking with Irene Kakandis and Steve Gordon. They're co-authors of a new book on the importance of discussing death and dying. And listeners, I'd like to invite you into this conversation. We'd love to hear from you. How are you talking with your loved ones about the end of your life, or maybe what's stopping you from doing so? You can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. And Irene and Steve, we're already getting some really thoughtful comments from people, as you might imagine, who are thinking about these things. Jay says, to echo, Irene, what you've been saying, a dying person's last wishes are very important. Loved ones should reassure the person who is dying that they will carry those wishes out. For example, the ailing person wants no ceremony, no celebration of life. Well, when someone says, come on, we're going to give you a ceremony whether you like it or not, this can be really upsetting to the person dying, knowing that his or her wishes won't be carried out. Steve, do you encounter that feeling of, you know, people say, here are my wishes, but sometimes if the wishes don't do anything, that can be really hard for the people who are left alive?
I'm not sure I understood you saying if the wishes are things that the people left behind might not want to carry out.
Well, Jay says, you know, if somebody says, "Don't give me a celebration of life. I don't want any ceremony," and then the loved ones are saying, "Oh, come on, we love you. We're going to give you a ceremony anyway." That's distressing to the person who says, "That's not what I want."
Yeah. So I guess one answer would be, don't tell them. Do if you're going to do it anyway, don't tell them. You know, another book that we quote in there is called "Bodies in Motion and at Rest," I think, and he talks about that author talks about a woman who was pretty instrumental in analyzing and sometimes critiquing the funeral industry, and she was very, very down on ceremony and big services and all that kind of stuff. And when she died, her kids gave her a huge celebration of her life, and their explanation was, it wasn't for her, it was for us.
Uh-huh. But Jane, I wanted to use your point to go somewhere slightly different, which is part of the point of the book, which is if those discussions had started earlier, the people who are trying to imagine your death for themselves might come to that conclusion and be able to discuss it with you and say, you know, I'm hearing you that you're telling me you don't want a service, you don't want a party, you don't want a celebration of your life, but my imagining to myself of what I'm going to feel like when you die is that I'm going to need to be together with people who loved you. And so would you perhaps reconsider? Now, as your writer mentioned, if that's at the point when someone is already literally in their last days of life, of course it would be very upsetting to them. But if it's a conversation that happened when you were both healthy and 40 years old, you have some time, hopefully, to let those thoughts sit and come back at each other with another angle, compare notes with people who maybe didn't do a funeral service or any kind of goodbye service. But if you leave it to those last days, yes, it could cause a lot of heartache in all kinds of directions.
And I would, to that point, too, say that if you do talk about it when you're 40 or 50 or 60, don't assume that whatever you decide at that point is set in stone. You know, these things change all the time. A lot of the work I do as a massage therapist is with people who are very sick with cancer and often people who are dying. And they, you know, there's a pretty I frequently hear from people who said that I told myself before that if my cancer came back or if I got cancer, I would never do this, I would never do that, I would never do chemo or do chemo again. But then you're there and you find you make decisions from a different place. And one of the reasons is your family or the people close to you. You know, you might decide long before you're sick that you would never do such and such a thing. But when it comes down to it, and not doing that means that you very well might die sooner, you might change your mind because of the people close to you who don't want you to go, who want you to be here as long as you can. That's a tricky balance. But again, discussing it is a way to understand not just what they want, but how you can incorporate what they want in how you feel and what you believe.
Well, and I guess to your points about keeping the avenue of conversation and communication open throughout your life, that you do leave yourself an opening for a changing viewpoint on your own death or what you'd like to have happen as you near death or after you die, so that it's not just the one conversation that you have at one point and then it's set in stone and you can never discuss it again because it was so uncomfortable.
Correct. Yeah.
We got a note from Susan in Colchester who says, "My dad died last month at 89 from complications of Alzheimer's. When I was a kid, there was a sealed envelope tucked into Dad's desk with the notation, 'Upon my death.' I don't know what it contained, but we found a similar envelope when he died with handwritten instructions about the service he wanted, including hymns and readings and many other details. My dad laughed when he'd hear someone say, 'If I die.' Susan says, 'We must learn to say, when I die, and deal with it. As Dad was fading away, now and then there would be a glimmer of him, and he would ask me to take care of my mother when he was gone. I never said, 'Oh, Dad, don't talk about that.' Instead, I held his hand and assured him, and we talked about the inevitable, and it seemed to soothe him." I wonder, Irene and Steve, as you've been thinking about death these many years, and we're going to talk about how you started this correspondence that led to this book, but if you have become more comfortable in having those kinds of conversations that Susan had, where there isn't that sense of, I'm just going to reassure you and we're not going to talk about this, but that these conversations, no matter who brings them up, can be this sort of open, warm, comfortable place to to just sort of sit with somebody and think about death and dying and your own experiences?
Well, there's no doubt that my life has been very marked by losing people I love a lot. I love them a lot, and it's been marked a lot. And I think the conversations Steve and I have had, both face-to-face and through the writing, definitely allowed me to say things it might not have occurred to me before were so important to say, and to react in a different way. In addition to sometimes seeing the signs, first of all, my condolences to this listener who has lost her dad recently. That's a very hard thing to lose a parent, no matter how old you are yourself. We lost our father about a year and a half ago. And I think I was able to go through his death in a way that was very loving because I had taken care of my personal business with him at an earlier stage in my life. And I was open to things like just trying to make him as comfortable as possible. When someone's dying, you don't want to be taking care of psychological business from 40 years prior or 20 years prior. You want to be able to be present to them, to be compassionate, to ease their pain if there's any way you can do that. And I think the more you've engaged these thoughts, the more available you are to people who need you in those moments, and the more aware you are of your own pain, both your own grieving, but also what you might want to do or not do about your own physical pain.
Let's go to Chris calling in from North Pomfret. Hi, Chris. Where do you come into this conversation?
Hi, how are you today?
Well, thanks. Go right ahead.
Good. I wanted to talk from the perspective of being a pastor who is with families, you know, while their loved one is approaching death and then in the moments and days afterwards, and say that the conversations about planning for health care in the last parts of life and planning for what happens after a person is dead are really important, not only for the life of the one who is approaching death, but also for those who will continue living. The research shows that families that have these conversations early on are much healthier as families after their loved one has died than those families who don't have these conversations. Oftentimes, families who don't have these conversations end up bitter and angry with each other because there's differing points of view. But if they can have the conversation beforehand and come to an agreement with their loved one, then they're much better off.
Chris, thanks for sharing your perspective. It's interesting to hear, you know, what you're experiencing with families and what you've been seeing. We're talking today about how to start the conversation about your death and death in general with the authors of a new book on the subject. They've been corresponding via email for 4 years about death and dying. Listeners, let us know what you think about having those conversations. Call 1-800-639-2211 or email us at vermontedition@vpr.net. Alana in Hardwick shared her perspective. She says, my 7-year-old has been to probably 10 funerals of friends and family members. I want my children to understand that death is just as natural and vital as birth. I cherish the peace I feel knowing that because Jesus Christ lovingly gave himself for all people, all will be resurrected. Great hope and comfort are mine because of the promise that families can be eternally joined. The love I feel from God and from my family gives me strength and erases fear. And Lissa says, my husband of 24 years died after a 10-week attack by biliary cancer in June of 2014. Tom had fought many cancers for 5 years before this last one. Our children and I helped Tom die at home, and because he was ill for so long, we were able to be as prepared as possible. His oncologist paid us the compliment of acknowledging we don't do drama. Following my husband's death, I tried to move on in the town where we lived, but only a drastic life change has enabled me to truly begin to heal. I literally looked at a map of the United States, reflected on what I needed in life and where there would be no memories of Tom, and here I am in Burlington. This may not be the answer for everyone, but it has been for me. Share your thoughts about death, mortality, grief, spirituality. Again, go to vpr.net and click on Vermont Edition or call 1-800-639-2211. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Can you picture a dinner party where the main focus of the conversation revolves around death and how you approach your own mortality, your loved ones, your kids? Today, we're having that kind of conversation, thinking about death, dying, grief, spirituality. Share the conversation with us. Call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. We're talking with Irene Kakandas and Steve Gordon, the co-authors of a new book on the importance of discussing death and dying. It's called Let's Talk About Death. And we're getting lots of comments from you as well, our listeners. Jeff in Grand Isle emailed, "What about giving religious services to those who were not religious at all? For instance, my father was an atheist and his wife insisted on burying him with a religious ceremony and had a Catholic cross put on his tombstone. This, to me, offended my father's memory." Elena says, "In many Buddhist countries like Bhutan, discussions of death occur 5 or more times a day. It's a normal part of their daily conversations." Well, it's a part of our conversation today. In fact, it's the whole focus of our conversation. So again, share your thoughts at vpr.net by clicking on Vermont Edition. Steve and Irene, this book that you've written, Let's Talk About Death, is told through emails. You've edited them and sort of curated them, but they're emails that you exchanged over several years. Irene, how did this conversation even get started?
Well, Steve and I had a contact over an event that was very, very sad and affected many people in the listening area, and that was the murder of Huff and Susanna Zantop, who were my dear friends and colleagues at Dartmouth College. And when the event happened, those who were close to them were really stunned by the wave of media interest, and particularly the nature of that interest, which was to get the most horrific details, the most salacious story about what had happened. And that was, of course, very offensive to us, speaking of the memory of someone who's gone. So as the first year anniversary of the murders was approaching, we thought to ourselves, and this is a large group of friends, not just myself, let's be proactive. And we approached the Valley News about putting our own stories about the Zantops and the wonderful lives they had lived and our relationships to them, rather than what we knew would happen, which was a lot of focus on the teenage murderers. So it just turns out that Mr. Steve Gordon was the editor of the Sunday Valley News, and he was our interlocutor, and he cooperated in a way that really struck me as very different from what we'd experienced with other media people. So when I saw his name come up many years later as having started a nonprofit organization that was giving massage to the dying, I was very, very impressed both with the mid-career switch but also with the brilliant idea to give free massage to people in this difficult stage of their lives. So I wrote a letter, and without dragging your listeners through all the details, eventually Steve and I did actually meet, and it took off like wildfire. We just couldn't stop talking to each other, even though we both had appointments coming up later that day. And so we thought, well, maybe there's some kind of future in us talking to each other. And then we had to move it to email because I was leaving the country. So that's the origin of this. I don't think we originally thought we would publish our correspondence, but at a certain point we realized, wow, all these thoughts we're having are here in this correspondence, and maybe we could share it with others, and it would be helpful to them because it's so much in a tentative form. You'll see over and over again if you get a chance to read the book, not only is it structured by questions and answers, but the answers are very tentative, and we often change our minds. We often change our minds because of reading what the other person had written. So we felt that openness was the appropriate way to approach mortality, that there aren't one set of correct answers for what to do in these very difficult circumstances. There's just the set of answers that feels right to you. And so we thought by modeling that, maybe readers would be inspired, they would take courage and do it themselves.
Well, Michelle from White River Junction certainly was. She said, "Initially, when I began reading Let's Talk About Death, I wasn't certain the format would appeal to me in the same way as a traditionally published narrative. However, I find myself reading each email exchange and pondering them individually and then collectively, just as I would any well-written book." Steve, as Irene mentioned, and as you've mentioned earlier in our conversation, you changed careers from journalism to massage, and you set up the Hand to Heart Project to give free massages to people with advanced cancer. What did motivate you to make that part of your practice?
Well, the first switch, of course, was transitioning from 25, 30 years in journalism to massage, which I had gotten interested in actually when I was in college and never really followed up on, but when my son graduated from college in the late 90s, he graduated in May, and that September I was in a massage training program and very fortunate to be in a job where I could do both for a while, and even as my massage practice picked up to cut back to more part-time at the newspaper. But very early in my massage career, I had the experience of a few people close to me being diagnosed with cancer and going through that, and it just took my focus. I mean, I have a massage practice in Hanover that's a very standard practice, and it's wonderful. I love the people I work with. But I also have the Hand to Heart Project, which gives me the opportunity to go into people's homes, the homes of people who are going through cancer treatment for advanced cancer or who are approaching the end of their lives. And we work with people who are expecting to be well after their treatment. And have many times been with people who are within a couple hours of dying and no longer awake.
What does that feel like to be with a person in that space?
Well, it's pretty amazing. I mean, it feels like you're sharing one of the most powerful mysteries and moments that life offers. The continuum of life has a beginning and an end, and they overlap. My life overlaps with many other lives, and I've had a chance to live that with people. And often they're people I become pretty close to in very short terms. I've said many times that some of the most amazing relationships I've ever had have been the shortest. Maybe as little as days, weeks, or a few months. Huh.
We have other listeners who are pondering the same kinds of questions that you two have been over the years, and I want to make sure we get some of their calls in. Greta is calling in from Jericho. Hi, Greta. Go right ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Well, thanks. Go ahead.
Thank you. First, I wanted to say thank you for this this spot. It's very important subject matter. In 2012, I was diagnosed with stage 3 malignant melanoma, which is an incurable disease, and have since April of 2014 have progressed to stage 4. So I've had to face the reality that, at the time I was diagnosed, I was only 46 years old, that my life is definitely going to be shorter than I would have hoped. I think that being a person with a terminal illness, I've gone through, obviously, the stages of grief that are typical and normal. And once that I got to the point where I could emotionally handle that fact, my attention turned to my family, friends, and loved ones. And I think that this conversation has to be continuous and is very important. There are many gifts that the acceptance of the patient, the person dying, can have as your life is going to be shorter. There's some very important procedural gifts you can do, like taking care of all of your, the final wishes and the things that have already been discussed on the program. But, making sure your insurance information is in order and all that type of thing, really just to eliminate that burden off the people that you're leaving behind. But even more importantly, I feel like the emotional gifts that you can give the people that you care about are essential. I think the pastor's name that called in was Chris, and he was talking about the emotional well-being of the families that have these conversations versus those that don't. And I don't want anybody that I love to have guilt about anything. I have a teenage daughter. Actually, she's turning 21. My husband, my parents, my sister. I don't want anybody to feel badly about anything or have any regrets. And making sure that the tough conversations are had when you have the time and the health and the ability to do so is so important.
Well, Greta,
so I've tried to turn. Go ahead.
I was going to say I'm very sorry to hear about your diagnosis, but I really appreciate you sharing the perspective that you have on this and how you're dealing with it and dealing with having these conversations, which I imagine, even if you've come to terms with, may still be difficult for some of those who know you and love you to come to terms with. So I really appreciate you sharing. Let's get another thought in here from Lori in Essex Junction. Hi, Lori. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for having me. I happen to have a costume rental shop, and I think it was about year and a half ago, I had a really interesting customer. A woman came in who was throwing a party that was themed costumes through the decades, like 50s, 60s costumes, and she needed to rent something for it. And it turned out that she, and I really don't know her circumstances as to why she was discussing her wishes after her death, but she said that she had told her friends and family that, you know, after she died, she wanted a huge costume party with this theme, and that everybody would have lots of fun and be all in their costumes and celebrate her life. And she said while she was telling them, she realized that she'd like to go to it. So she decided to throw the big party while she was still around. And like I said, I don't really know her personally, but I thought that was such a wonderful idea. And she was able to carry out her wishes and actually be there. And
Lori, yeah, thank you for sharing that story. What a fun one to think about, throwing your own end-of-life party and being able to be there for it.
Can I add something?
Steve, I was going to come back to you guys.
Well, I was just – there's a people – the topic keeps coming up about how much of a help it can be for you – for the person who is ill or dying to be able to talk about this. And – you know, one thing I've seen a lot with families and clients I've worked with is people, husbands, wives, adult kids, avoiding the topic because either they can't go there or they don't want to bring the person who's sick down. And the fact is that what I have found is that people need and want to talk about it. It's a really important thing. And one of the stories I tell, it's wonderful in the book, is that I get to tell a lot of stories from hand to heart. But one story that actually came from well before that was, I ran into a woman in the supermarket who I was from my town, who I knew had advanced cancer, and she actually did not live a whole lot longer than past when I saw her. But she was going through up and down the aisle, and I didn't even know her that well, but we bumped into each other. I said, "Hi, how are you doing?" We stood in the aisle of the supermarket for 45 minutes. She was telling me what was going on with her, and I know that part of the reason was she had nobody at home. Her husband could not go there. And people, I see it all the time. People need and want to talk about it, and you do give them such a gift if you can do it with them.
Irene, has this changed the way you think about your own death? Having these conversations with Steve, and then thinking about putting this out there in the world.
I would say yes and no is the honest answer. That on some level, I was already moving in this direction, I think, but I do feel much more conscious of the decisions I want for myself. I've had some health challenges recently, and it's been much easier to face those with a lot of equanimity, just calmness and peace. I think because of the conversations we've had, I think also going through other people's deaths with them, the way I was able to be with my dad for the last 8 days of his life, are reassuring. It helps you realize it's possible and you can do it. And my father died with a lot of dignity, actually, even though he had been severely demented and had many health problems. And I think that gave me a lot of hope about trying to do it myself. Steve has in a place in the book where he says, you know, our parents are our models for how we might die. And that's not always the case. Sometimes children, of course, die before their parents. But it's very reassuring when you take your models from wherever. Steve's been able to take some from his clients. I think I've been able to take some positive and negative models from deaths I've been close to. And it'll help you for the unprepared events, too, which unfortunately a lot of people are experiencing right now with the violence in the world.
Yeah, certainly something a lot of people are thinking about. That's Irene Kakandas. She's a professor of German studies and comparative literature at Dartmouth College. And Steve Gordon has also been with us. He's a massage therapist in Hanover and Cornish, New Hampshire. They are the co-authors of Let's Talk About Death, Asking Questions That Profoundly Change the Way We Live and Die. Steve and Irene, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having us on. It was great.
Thank you so much, Jane. And I'm glad so many people in Vermont and New Hampshire are thinking about these issues. That's our hope.
Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. The Global Climate Change Summit in Paris, known as COP21, is in its second week, and world leaders are wrangling over the language in a potential agreement that would aim to curb greenhouse gas emissions and slow the warming of the planet. But beneath the top-level negotiations are 30,000 attendees at the summit who are going to talks and participating in panels where knowledge, experience, and questions are shared. Among the attendees is Vermont's Natural Resources Secretary, Deb Markowitz. Markowitz spoke with me this morning from Paris Harris about her purpose in attending the summit.
The real reason that I'm here and local leaders are here is to show the world, to show the national leaders who are negotiating what we hope to be a very strong and meaningful agreement, that in our communities, in our states, in our regions, we are actually getting things done, and that we're committed moving forward. Vermont, along with 80 different jurisdictions, has signed on to a memorandum of understanding. It's called the Under 2 MOU, where we're committing to take actions that will help prevent the warming of the earth more than the 2 degrees that scientists say are necessary to keep us safe.
And is that understanding that you and these other jurisdictions have signed on regardless of what your national leaders do?
Yes, that's true. And we have a very specific plan as to how we're going to achieve our part of the goal, as will each of the other 80 jurisdictions have as part of this movement. We've had a lot of ceremony around it. It's been very interesting being in meeting halls with people speaking 80 different languages from all over the world. Some of the countries have felt the extreme impacts of climate change, making our experience in Tropical Storm Irene seem like a picnic. I mean, it really is amazing when you speak to people who've lost thousands of people to climate-related disasters, and where whole communities have been destroyed and will never be recovered. It really is urgent that we act.
You're a panelist as well at several different forums. What from Vermont's experience are you actually sharing with others at this conference?
Well, there's a lot of different things we're doing in Vermont that are actually truly innovative. I think Vermonters would be surprised to know that there are very few places in the world that have a cap-and-trade system like we do with the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. The REGI is what we call it, has been tremendously successful in reducing the carbon pollution from the electric sector in our region and bringing money into Vermont to help us afford efficiency programs that have added additional greenhouse gas benefits and frankly have made people more comfortable in their homes as we tighten up people's houses. Examples like that are important for other jurisdictions to learn about. There's a lot of interest in ways that we could put a price on carbon, and a carbon tax is certainly one way, but a cap and trade program is another way, and we've had success there.
So you feel like you've been well received when you've had these speaking engagements? I mean, when you're a panelist.
Oh, we've been very well received. The question that I get, I mean, I was in a conversation with the Minister of Environment from some of the regions in China, a Minister of Environment from one of the regions in Mexico, and they're very much interested in whether or not our cap and trade programs could merge. They haven't started them. In China, they have a very ambitious goal. In Mexico and a few of the regions are beginning to look at how to set these up. They're very much interested in whether or not once we have more of these markets, whether or not there's a way to strengthen them by joining them. It's complicated, so I don't know whether it, as a practical matter, will be possible. But that shows the kind of interest there is out there in the work we're doing in Vermont.
Is there anything that you've heard from other panelists or other speakers that you feel like is an aha moment for you to bring back to Vermont?
Well, people in Vermont who know me know that I am always, an optimist, that I'm always looking for the opportunity. And I have to say, I'm going to be coming back feeling the urgency of this effort more than ever. Tropical Storm Irene was a wake-up call for us in Vermont. But when I talk to people in the Maldives, when I talk to folks who live in the Middle East or in the Fiji Islands and see that many of them are losing large parts of their society, their civil society, because of climate-related impacts, it really breaks my heart, and it makes me really recognize that there's a moral imperative to act, that Vermont needs to play its part, to speak loud and clear and as bold as possible. This is it's a big deal for Vermont. It is really a big deal for parts of the world where people are already struggling.
You know, Secretary Markowitz, we know there's some very real wrangling going on among world leaders at this climate change conference, and the clock is ticking on that agreement, which is supposed to be signed by Friday. And so far, it looks like remarkably, it's actually on schedule. But that's sort of going on at the top level, and the U.S. is a major player in that. But is there really any purpose in having you and Governor Shumlin and people from other states go to this conference? I mean, conferences can be full of feel-good exercises and cocktail hours where you make real connections, but is there a real purpose to having you there?
Well, there is. So if you think about how we got here as a world to COP21, this is the meeting of the parties that the UN brings together to negotiate the climate agreement. You know, so we have the Kyoto Protocol. It's going to be ending in 2020, and so there's been an effort to develop a new agreement by the time that runs out. And there's been a series of meetings. The last major meeting was in Copenhagen in 2009, and it really fell flat. In that meeting, there was a failure of leadership to adopt any binding limits. They took a very top-down approach and were not successful. Because of that lack of success, the subnational jurisdiction, that's big cities and states and regions and provinces, took the lead. And right now, if you look nationally at what's going on, most of the real climate mitigation and climate resilience action is happening on the state and regional level. And so it's very important that we're present to show what we've accomplished during this downtime since 2009 when the nations failed to act. So it puts pressure on the negotiators. It shows that it is actually possible to make things work. And what's really important is we're the ones who manage the impact. You know, the U.S. government, you know, through FEMA, they put out money, they help. But really, when there's a disaster, it's happening in our communities, and we have to pick up the pieces. So it's been very important. And I have to tell you, Governor Shumlin's here. Governor Brown has spent the whole week. Governor Inslee is here. And every time any of us speak, there's press there covering what we're saying because it really matters.
Are you able to follow at all what's happening at the top level with this big agreement and the back and forth between China and the United States and India and other countries?
Oh, yes. As part of what we're doing here is, you know, we're being briefed twice a day on what's happening with the talks. And it is, you know, it is very hopeful. You know, there are places that the negotiators, you know, aren't going to go, and it's unfortunate. And one of the you know, we see lots of protests here. There are a lot of activists, obviously, and many of the activists are concerned that the countries, the agreement is not going to have money on the table, a specific amount to help poorer countries deal with the impacts of climate change. And so there are issues that have been taken off the table, but the critical issue of greenhouse gas emissions and the under 2 goal. Now they're talking about a 1.5% aspiration. I think that will be meaningful and good. It will spur innovation, the innovation that we need to actually be able to reach those goals while maintaining economic prosperity for our countries.
You said 1.5% aspiration, but it's 1.5 degrees, right? There's conversation
about... I'm sorry, not percent. Yes, 1.5 degrees.
Well, Secretary Markowitz, thanks very much for speaking with us in the midst of your time at COP21. Safe travels home, and thanks.
Well, thank you.
That's Vermont Natural Resources Secretary Deb Markowitz speaking with me this morning from Paris. Markowitz says her travel and attendance at COP21 was paid for by the Georgetown Climate Center. She and officials from other U.S. states are attending as part of that delegation. That's it for today. Now, Vermont is changing its acceptable agricultural practices from recommendations into required agricultural practices, which means that Vermont's small farms will now have to follow them by law. Tomorrow on the show, we'll talk about the changes and find out why the Ag Agency is asking for your input. Send your questions or comments to vermontedition@vpr.net and listen tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri and Sam Gail Rosen, with production assistance from Hannah Kearns. Mary Williams directed the show, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.